Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I am Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Shazam and Dumbo. So let's start off with Shazam, Mike.
Well, the marketing pitch for this film is Big Meets Superman.
Yes, that's a great way of putting it.
And it really does deal, as so many superhero movies deal, with questions of identity. When you think about the incredible popularity of this kind of film, this sort of superhero genre or subgenre, whatever we want to call it, the fact that so often you have a superhero who is really kind of bewildered by his status, human, not quite human, whatever. And so many of the movies deal with that. And as they go into sequels, still grappling with the ramifications, the ripple effects of what it means to be fill-in-the-blank superhero. And that's why that not only facilitates sequels, which are inevitable, but within each sequel, all the flashbacks too, right? Like, well, how did we get into this mess? And, you know, and why am I not quite human kind of things? And certainly in Shazam, there is a lot by way of origin story. There's a lot by way of, you know, how do you end up like this? And then how do you get out of it? And then, of course, all along the way, there's so many breadcrumbs there by way of, you know, a sequel or sequels will be coming. And so all that, all the references in this film to Superman and Batman and other things, and you know they're all going to pop up in various configurations in the future.
One thing I would like to mention to anybody thinking about going to see it is that the previews don't do it justice. It's a better movie than the previews lead you to believe.
Well, the previews are really clunky, aren't they?
Very.
Really, it's almost like at that one joke kind of level, like ha-ha sort of thing in terms of, you know, him being oftentimes a sort of inept or quasi-inept superhero, which is funny, you know, like you're going to fly through the air and get to the top of a building, but you sort of hit it midway up and go through the window.
Yes.
I mean, there's some very funny stuff there, but if it's just at that level, I would think after three or four iterations, as in the previews, you kind of laugh yourself out. You'd say, well, the guy's a klutz, you know, and that's in the film, but fortunately, there's more than that.
I noticed a couple of big references, one of them being the toy store with the piano in the floor gambit.
Yeah, you know, Tom Hanks, of course, was in Big way back in 1988. And you know, part of this genre's appeal to its ardent fans is the fact that it's so self-referential. You know, superhero movies referencing other superhero movies, but also within the larger orbit of pop culture, the ways in which these films are omnivorous. They just suck it all in. And the animated films, you know, even more so to take all that in. So, you know, the whole fact, because in Shazam, the whole idea is for like really ridiculous reasons, you could be a kid and suddenly you could find yourself zapped into superhero status as an adult, but you still basically have a kid's mentality or outlook and so on. So what's it like to be a kid trapped not only in an adult's body, but in a very tight-fitting outfit where, you know, definitely adult, right?
Right.
And the film has some fun with that, actually, but in a way very similar to Tom Hanks in Big. Like, if you suddenly, you're a kid and suddenly, you know, for supernatural reasons, find out you're adult, you know, adolescence is tough enough as it is, right? But then suddenly when you get zapped into full maturity like that, that can do a number on your head. It's a real head trip. So the quick reference that you were making is very quick in the film, namely that there's a very specific reference to the F.A.O. Schwartz, you know, toy room, if you will, in terms of walking across the piano keys. And one thing I like about Shazam, it gave but didn't belabor that moment. I didn't count the seconds, but let's say 10 seconds that it lasts. Just enough so you recognize it, it registers, you laugh, and then you move on.
What is missing is some of the jokes that were unintentional and big, where Tom Hanks, as the adult who's really still a child, would say things that were incredibly insightful, not realizing he was saying something really insightful, like talking to the guy who owns the company, and the guy said something about a profit and loss statement or something, and he says something like, well, what's that? And he, the older man, you know, takes it as, why are we talking about that unimportant thing, rather than this genuine question of, I don't know what you're talking about. But it becomes this, when people see an adult, they think that they are an adult. Those kinds of things worked in Big, but they didn't do that in Shazam, which I think was a little bit of a missed opportunity.
Well, the film itself is relatively superficial. It doesn't really, it doesn't dive deep or delve too much in that. Big qualified more in terms of a, I mean, it sounds overly ponderous to say, you know, psychological study, but it followed through more consistently on the basic premise Here, it's a bit more sporadic. It's kind of scattershot. Sometimes it's perceptive and follows through. Sometimes it's just being silly and just goes on the surface that way. And again, the film, you know, opened to very strong box office. It's yet another franchise immediately in the making there. And so it works, you know, in terms of audience taste, but it's not exactly a deep film at that level of what would happen to you if. It has some fun with it, but just basically kind of coasts with it, I think.
Well, in Big, of course, he finds that Mr. Majestic and makes a wish. And then, of course, he has to find it later to undo it because he doesn't want to stay in the where he ends up. They use the carnival, of course, in Shazam as well. But there it's this opportunity to, how can we wreck giant rides with people on them and have you go through that whole terror of what happens if you fall off the top of it, which is, I think, such a Hitchcock moment, to get something in there about fear of falling.
Well, one of the problems I had is with so many superhero movies, once you get into a special effects spectacle, the mistaken belief, I think, at the studio end is that, you know, more is better. And the film has a running time of 132 minutes, which isn't bad by superhero standards. But there are sequences, especially in carnival ground settings, that go on longer than they really need to. Because it's like, gee, look at how much devastation and destruction we could cause here. And, you know, particularly, you know, when you have a Ferris wheel or any kind of theme park ride, the stuff you can do. And it's engaging. But again, for me, that's part of the superficial appeal. A lot of this is just the sort of violent eye candy, if you will. And there's not much actual violence in this, but just violent in the sense if I were on top of a Ferris wheel and there are fires raging or the wheel's spinning or something, it would strike me as violent, I think, at the moment. But the fact that simply that sequences like that just go on longer than they need to for story purposes. And it's one reason why the film doesn't have as much psychological depth as Big would in terms of, you know, character study. Here, the character study is oftentimes just at the surface of you were a kid, now you're an adult. You know, the uniform you have on is so silly with the lightning bolt coming down the tights and so on. But you're sort of a live action cartoon at that point.
They do the same thing with the Hulk. That once he says Shazam and he becomes full size and he's wearing this costume, and then when he comes out of it, it's just, you know, a memory of it with the hoodie, the red hoodie. You see the hood. Nothing is explained about how you go back and forth. That's got to be some serious spandex.
Well, it is. And watching the movie, I felt let down because at a few points I said Shazam, and then I looked, I was the same, and nothing had changed. I wanted a little more muscle to come out of this or something, but no such luck.
That's the tough thing about that superhero gig. You know, actually, speaking of Hitchcock, it reminds me of Strangers on a Train with the, you know, the scene on the merry-go-round. And, you know, the little bit of humor where, you know, the older man tries to crawl underneath it to, you know, make his way towards the mechanism that has been trapped in the on and super fast position. You almost need those little beats of, if you're going to use the carnival, you have to use it in a creative way. And it's just sort of a backdrop here. But in a way, I think that's intentional because I think the whole idea of the small person inside a bigger person's body is something that everybody sort of feels at sometimes, that, you know, you may look like you know what you're doing, but inside you're thinking more like a child, like, I'm scared, I don't know what I'm doing. Sure hope everybody is fooled.
Well, it's a funny thing to talk about because on the one hand, it's a welcome scenario because we've all felt that. On the other hand, familiarity may be over familiarity in some ways. And this was a case where it took a long time to get this character to the screen like this. And the backstory is actually kind of interesting that the original figure was Captain Marvel, okay? And this actually was invented in 1939. That's how far back it goes in comic book history, just a year after Superman. And he was looked on as a Superman knockoff, if you will. And it never quite fully caught on. It was always sort of like a second-tier figure. And then what happened was in the 1950s, there was an actual lawsuit that Marvel Comics had filed in terms of the name itself. And I don't know all the details of the lawsuits in the 50s, but the end result was that Marvel ended up getting that name, Captain Marvel. That sort of switched over to another comic book universe, if you will. And what happened was then that here, DC was able to resurrect the figure under the name Shazam in 1972. So it's another iteration of it there. but then not quite sure what to do with it because it still hadn't fully caught on as a distinctive figure. So the particular film we're talking about actually has its origins as a film in the early 2000s. And at that point, when films like The Dark Knight are coming out, you have a basic conceptual decision. Do we go serious or do we go silly? And this script kind of bounced around. Even William Goldman, you know, from All the President's Men, even he had a crack at the script. And then there was yet another iteration of it after he dropped out that would have involved Shazam and a sidekick partner, Black Adam, who was being played by Dwayne Johnson. And then that fell apart, and now Dwayne Johnson's going to do that as a standalone. Then it came to the current script that we're seeing here on screen now. But then they spent a lot of time auditioning actors and trying to get the right mix. And it may be one reason why the film, as we watch it, to me at least seemed, I mean, I have the names of the director and screenwriter and all that, but it seems to me like a film by committee in a lot of ways. It just seems like they wrestled with all these issues and came up with a kind of safe, generic take on it. You know, not as psychologically deep as the child become adult of a big template, and not an all-out special effects extravaganza, and not all this, not all that. It's just sort of like what I call like down the middle of the road. One of the things that saves it there is that Zachary Levi, who plays Shazam, was, you know, picked after like 100 people were auditioning, and he's actually quite good in the role. I think he kept, because he's able to be fully adult in appearance, but there's still enough childlike qualities in the way he talks and inflection, vocal inflections, things like that, that I thought that was quite convincing.
How did you like the bully subplot?
Not at all.
Yeah, I didn't think it needed it.
No, it's somebody in writing about the film said it's sort of like a kind of tired segment of a Bowery Boys movie or something. It sort of plays that way. And again, that's where, because the film is coming out of so many familiar elements, genre elements and related genres, it just doesn't seem very fresh there. It seems sort of pro forma that you have this bullying. Because that's like, okay, well, you know, every movie should have an anti-bullying moment. I realize that. I want that bumper sticker too. But when you get it in the film here, it just seems like kind of tired, kind of predictable that would be there.
And they aren't vanquished enough. You know, there's, you know, what happens to their truck, and then there's being beat up with the brother's crutch, and then, you know, then there's the scene on the Ferris wheel. It's like, just resolve it. Just resolve it.
Well, you know what happens there? Because there's so many elements at play here, you know, in terms of child size, adult size, et cetera, that the bullies kind of drop in and out of the storyline. Sometimes they disappear for long stretches. Where I think you're absolutely right. If you're going to have bullies, they not only do they need to be punished, but, boy, the opportunities for punishment here, because this is a movie that actually has the seven deadly sins.
Right.
I mean, you could be punished in all kinds of unusual ways. And the movie just doesn't quite follow through on some of its own material in that respect.
Now, the seven deadly sins was another thing I had a problem with, because they're supposedly being kept at bay, but just barely. And yet, here we are in the world with all those sins alive and well.
I was afraid I would be put in the witness box having to explain how the seven deadly sins operate. Because honestly, it was so inconsistent. I wasn't quite sure. I mean, I know what those sins are, not to confess too much. I mean, I know what those sins are, but I wasn't quite sure how the film was going to deal. Like, what are they exactly? How do they operate? What are the controls on them? It was so arbitrary. Let's put it that way. It was so arbitrary in the film that ultimately was meaningless. So when they would come popping back to life again, not only was I not scared, I was wanting to laugh at them almost. Like, oh, well, here's gluttony again. And it was a silliness at that point. You know, there was no real sense of, I mean, I know it's a PG-13 movie, but there's no real sense of menace or of consequence. Let's put it that way.
Yes, although it was really cool the way they could turn into smoke.
Yes, that was kind of cool, but just on its own as an effect. On a metaphysical level, it's still foggy. It doesn't clear up anything for me there. It's just another opportunity to show that carnival grounds are dangerous places. You don't want to go there.
Don't go there for any reason. Bad stuff. Actually, that does seem to be the message of the recent spate of movies.
Yeah, very much so. You know, and again, it's sort of a zeitgeist thing that's hard to explain there. Like, why, when you get certain films like this, they oftentimes seem like they were shot in the same location even. You know, I mean, like what is it with carnival grounds? Like, give it a rest for a while. Have it take place someplace else. But, you know, that's kind of obvious in the sense that, you know, certain directors and certain genres are at home in a place like that because they're real and not real. It's a place where you pay your money to be scared. And we want things to sometimes be a little ambivalent in terms of, well, is this really happening or not? And then, you know, what do you do when you're on the roller coaster? You pay to be scared, and then when you get off, you put your money down again to be scared again. And that's the movie-going experience with films like this. So again, it's part of that self-reflexive quality of films like this, is that the very setting at a carnival ground facilitates that.
So moving on to the other carnival ground movie, Dumbo. one of the things I thought was really kind of precious about it that worked really is the way they portray the carnival as clean. You know, you see people who are like the standard folks that you're expecting to find at the carnival, the bearded lady and the sword swallower and all these guys. But there's no sense of homelessness. There's no drunken clowns. There's none of the seedy underworld.
Well, but this actually goes back as far as like Todd Browning's Freaks in 1932, the fact that for those of us on the outside, it is a freak show, to say a very un-PC thing. Mm-hmm. It's so different, so unusual, and potentially, and oftentimes not just potentially, in movies, it is so threatening in various ways. But then there will be movies, you know, all along the way in which when you're on the inside of that, it's a family. And it's normal for them, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's their normal life. And the abnormal people are the tourists who come in to see it. And so I rather like that about, I mean, I was not particularly enthusiastic about Dumbo, but one thing I did like was the fact that when you're on the inside, this is, you know, whether somebody's extremely tall or short or thin or fat or has, you know, unusual attributes, whatever, that's normal for them. And so there's a kind of healthy attitude that they would have. And carnivals tend to be that way, actually. They are tight-knit families.
Oh, Danny DeVito is actually magnificent as the master of ceremonies, born to play that role.
He was born to play that.
He really was. So I thought that was genius, actually, having him in that role. And he gives it some heart and a little bit of humor.
He animates every scene that he's in.
Yes.
He's really terrific. And I met him once, and he's like that in life. He's got that outsized personality. I mean, diminutive frame, but outsized personality. It's genuine there. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from the acting skills, but he's a people person that way. He's really outgoing. And I mean, sometimes a little bit goes a long way, but he's really got that high energy quality to him and a real mensch, if you will. And in this film, it's one reason why it's so well cast is that when he's in a scene there, he helps to pull together that family of, you know, quote unquote misfits, you know, that he's overseeing all that. And you know, Tim Burton sort of made a career that he's always on the side of the outsider. And for Burton to direct this film is sort of a given. I mean, you know, he's at home on
a carnival
ground. Yeah, absolutely. If anything, maybe he's coasting a bit as a director in the first hour or so of this film because it's so familiar to him. It's so comfortable as material for him that I don't think he does as much creatively as he could with it. But by the same token, you kind of enjoy being there because he just knows that turf really well.
I liked the faithfulness to the original. It was very much like the cartoon. Even the way they rendered Dumbo with their eyes a little bit too, you know, not really where they are on a real elephant, but to look more human, more adorable. I think that they did a great job with Dumbo. I also sprung for the 3D, and I thought the 3D was really well done in the movie, especially the scenes where you have extreme height or things flying around. Really, really cool.
So could I make a two-dimensional observation?
Yes.
having seen it in that format. There's cute and there's cutesy, and it was cute in a way that I liked, and you know, there's nothing quite like a flying elephant. Don't ask me to explain why, but it's a pleasure to watch a flying elephant. And also the way the ears were drooping so much. Mm-hmm. That I bought, and that smile on the face, you wanted to adopt him, to take him home. Mm-hmm. And so, but where it spilled into the cutesy, it had to do with the eyes, actually. Not only is this elephant blue-eyed, but it's like remarkably blue-eyed. So I realized I wasn't the only one who was kind of struck by that it was maybe getting a little too cute there. When Anthony Lane was reviewing this film in the New Yorker magazine, this is what he said about the elephant's eyes, quote, "So alarmingly blue that he appears to be 95% pachyderm and 5% Paul Newman."
Wow. Okay. That's, yeah. I think that he hit that right on the head.
But that's a problem when you get films like this where the protagonist is meant to be incredibly cute. Does it ever become cloying, like too much? And I thought here there were times where it was really milking it. It was really, you know, pushing it that way. And the reason in particular that it started to rankle a bit was that even though Tim Burton certainly has this sense of whimsicality, I wanted a little more edge at times here. But the thing that ultimately bothered me was just simply a kind of business observation I had, namely that Disney obviously knows how to make a lot of money. And what they've been doing in recent years, and we'll see even more of this in years ahead if you want to, you know, ride this current, is taking their catalog of animated films and doing live-action versions. Let me give a quick list of ones they've done or are in the process of doing. We have Jungle Book, Lion King, Aladdin, Mulan, The Sword in the Stone, Cinderella. on and on there.
Alice
and then,
in Wonderland?
Yeah. Alice in Wonderland, on and on. I mean, it's just bottomless that way, endless that way. And then so Lane, in that same review in The New Yorker, says, he didn't use the word craven, but an almost craven quality of what Disney can do here. He said, quote, "What matters is that they rub the lamp and rack up the gold."
Mm-hmm.
And watching the film, I was a bit bothered by that because I thought, geez, you know, will this ever end? Like all of our beloved cartoons that we grew up on, now we could do a live action version of it. And some of those will work, I know, aesthetically, commercially. Some of the others, you just feel like, you know, they're kind of going through the motions of material that's at hand. You have the copyright. You have it all there. Now just, you know, do it live. And not that that's necessarily lazy, but to me, oftentimes I want to see films that really are doing something new, something different, and not just mining from the same mine.
I noticed an awful lot of Disney references within the movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I wanted to go out and buy merchandise. I mean, I was being prompted.
The one that I thought was the most obvious, but I thought it worked and was charming, was when there's a scene with Bubbles that turn into Heffalumps and Woozles. From Winnie the Pooh. I mean, there were lots of things where like, oh, that's from that other Disney movie. And, oh, there's another reference from that other movie. And I was noticing them, and then I realized, oh, this is intentional. And then I started thinking, how many did I miss before I realized that they were doing that?
They're absolutely doing that. And here's where Tim Burton maybe is having some fun with Disney itself. And Disney doesn't mind this so long as it can make money off of it, right? But the villain in this film, a character named is V.A. Vanderveer, that's a lot of V's, played by Michael Keaton, is the owner of Dreamland. So as that's being presented to us and his personality, he's a little bit like the dark side of Walt Disney himself. And that had to be in Tim Burton's mind. And I'm sure the people at Disney who know their own history would have been aware of that and let it go through because the references are there. I mean, here's an example historically in terms of the history within Dumbo, if you will. The film opens in 1919, and the character played by Colin Farrell, Holt, is back from the war and injured and so on. So it's very much an immediate post-World War I setting. Walt Disney himself had just come out of the Army and in the late teens was starting to work with other cartoonists and starting what would become Disney Studios. And it's in that very same time period he's doing that. So, you know, we have the Michael Keaton character running Dreamland, and Uncle Walt is already starting to think about, you know, Disneyland, if you will, the whole Disney empire. And I kind of like that in the sense that Tim Burton knows he's entering into venerable Disney material. So why not have some fun with it by way of references you mentioned and also simply reference Walt Disney himself that way in a character. And then not a very flattering portrait of the character
no,
at all.
No.
But Walt Disney definitely had a darker side. Talk to anyone who was involved with the labor unions and their strikes at the Disney studio in the early 40s. You know, Uncle Walt knew how to call out the Army and have the Army fire on his own employees.
The interesting thing also is that it's actually stated that amusement parks are really what happened to carnivals.
Yeah,
and the traveling circus, that you take all of those elements of being child-oriented and games and fantasy and role-play rides and all that stuff, and you don't have it on the road anymore. You have it as a destination. And that, I thought, was a very deep comment to make about that.
Well, it's one-stop shopping, isn't
right.
it? Once you have the person there, you have the person. They're going to stay in your hotel. They're going to spend their money at the theme park. They're going to buy products there and so on. And that becomes, and for all ages, whether it's kids, who would presumably be the big target audience, but also honeymooners and senior citizens and so on, you get the whole family there. And of course, that was always a part of Disney's genius. I mean, I've mentioned some of the less flattering aspects. Part of his genius was to make that entertainment in a way that, you know, the animated films in particular would appeal to everybody. I mean, Dumbo was a very popular film across the board. And this new Dumbo that came out did reasonably well. So it's also appealing to people.
Yeah, I think that the movie does a good job of updating it. I don't think it's a bad movie.
It's kind of a lazy film in the sense
it's lazy film.
It's such obvious material for Burton to take on. And you know, even much as I love A Flying Elephant, after about the third or fourth iteration, I thought, is it going to go around the ring again?
You know, the other thing that this makes me think of is Vegas is kind of the same thing for adults, that as a younger person, you might travel around to see somebody in concert. But then, you know, the great thing for your final part of your career is to be in residence at Vegas. People just come to you. You no longer have to go out.
If you're Celine Dion, why hit the road? Why travel? Mm-hmm. Just stay in Vegas where people pay a lot of money to see you do the same show over and over again.
And then they have all of the carnival aspects for adults,
I think she's animatronic by now.
They just press the button
and she performs the same songs.
So we have a little bit of time. We can talk about a movie we discussed very briefly on our way here called The Beach Bum.
Well, it gets my vote for the worst film of the year, and as we're talking now in April.
Well, it's a terrible movie, I'm not going to lie. But it is. It does have its moments. For one thing, the soundtrack is fantastic.
Well, a lot of movies get by with that, and I love music of that period, so sure. I mean, there are a lot of scenes where I might complain about the scene, but how could I complain about the soundtrack of my life?
Well, it also has an original new song by Jimmy Buffett.
Well, speaking of laziness, when Jimmy Buffett's the hardest working man in the film, but no, Jimmy Buffett appears as himself in this film, which is appropriate because, you know, after, it's set in Florida, it's very much beach bum territory, and the most exercise most people go is walking up to the tiki bar, you know, it's that kind of a thing. And there's not that much story to talk about per se. It's just all kinds of debauchery, if you will. And for me, that was one reason why I hated it so much. I wasn't opposed to debauchery so much as it just became ironically kind of boring after a while. And in fact, A.O. Scott in the New York Times Review said that, you know, quote, what the beach bum celebrates as transgression is pure tedium. Mm. Close quote. And it was exactly the way I felt, namely that, you know, I enjoyed, you know, debauchery as much as anyone, I suppose. And so, you know, if they're going to, you know, smoke and drink and all the other carrying on, I mean, that's good cinematic material, isn't it?
It is.
Even if it's vicarious in our own lives, we wouldn't. Of course not. We we'd never do that. But watching other characters do it in a film, sure. But here, scene after scene has almost no storyline to carry it. And just simply has, you know, one party after another. And, you know, after about an hour or so of that, I feel like I'm hungover. You know, I want to get out of there. Give me a cup of black coffee at that point.
I think there were a couple of things that people will respond to in the movie. One is I think everybody knows somebody who doesn't try at all and doesn't even appreciate what they have, but is nonetheless showered upon with success, money, what have you. I think it does a great job of showing you that kind of character because I think everybody can relate
well,
to that.
Logically, I agree with that, but at ground level with the film itself, it doesn't play because the character of Moondog is meant to be a famous poet.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when you hear his poetry, it's so god awful. You can't imagine how anyone ever, even by beat poetry standards, it's so bad. You can't imagine how anyone would ever, you know. Admittedly, a lot of his money came through the wife, the character of the wife. But you can't imagine how any kind of fame would adhere to that.
See, sadly, I thought the poems worked in the movie.
Yo.
I thought that they worked.
We have a poetry workshop just after this.
And I thought they were meant. I thought that it was meant to be a commentary about Bob Dylan, but that was just me. One of the things in the movie I thought was a unique take, something I haven't seen anybody do before, and I always give points for this in a movie because there's so many things that are, you know, retreaded, was this idea, and he actually says it too late in the movie. If he said it earlier, I think it would have made the movie work better. He says about himself, the Matthew McConaughey character, that he has the opposite of paranoia, where paranoia is where you think the whole world is out to get you. He instead feels like the whole world is out to make him happy. And when you understand that point of view, it's crazy, of course, but wow, wouldn't that be cool if you could actually think like that? You wouldn't want to be him. But isn't that a great outlook?
Well, it's a great outlook for him in the same sense that you have the feeling that the people making the movie had a great time mm-hmm. making it. Harmony Korine's the director of it, and you know movies like Gummo and Spring Breakers. And I always feel like those are usually terrible films, but they must have a heck of a good time making it because everyone's just misbehaving like wild in the film, and they're cracking each other up and all. But it's more fun for them than for me, and I felt that way here. That Matthew McConaughey, I mean, he's trademarked those you know slacker moves. Mm-hmm. He's perfect at it. It's not even acting anymore. He's just being there. But after about 5 minutes of that, I feel like, well, let him go have his party, and I'll go find entertainment somewhere else.
It must have been fun to make because there's so many famous people who walk on and off. Jonah Hill,
Snoop Dogg's in it. Zac Efron even pops up in Rehab, which I did think was funny that Zac's in Rehab.
Yeah, there's actually several moments they don't last long enough to save the movie that are either that was clever or that was unexpected. So I'm not the worst movie of the year. I'm sure something's going to be worse, but I'm not going to lie. It was not a good movie.
Was there even a script? Do you feel like the whole thing was just improv'd?
It could have been improv'd, and that might have been the beauty of it, except for the scene with the foot, which was way over the top for me, and that was... No.
So people will have to watch it if they want to get that reference, right?
Yes, you will. But I recommend watching it on DVD. I don't know how much longer it's going to be in the theaters anyway.
All right, pin that one on her. I'm not recommending it.
But yeah, if you do see it and you like it, don't tell Mike. And that wraps up our week. So thanks for joining us with At the Movies with Mike and Marie, and we will see you next time.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.